Welcome to the New York Times podcast, your Ask Me Why So Many Fade, But I'm Still Here. Of music, news, and criticism, I am your host, John Caramonica. I'll tell you one thing, I'm not on my own. I'm rolling with the team. Joe Coscarelli is here.
Yes, good morning.
Live from Los Angeles, live from Santa Monica, perhaps. Karen Gans is here.
Hi, John. It's me.
It's the problem, aka the problem. Lizzie Zoliz is here.
Hey, Karen took my joke, so.
Okay. And the biggest
I had an alternate.
We'll post game. And the biggest stepper is here, John Pareles.
Being emotionally abusive as usual.
Damn. We're starting off. Yo, okay. This podcast is dedicated to everybody who I have seen in the last couple of days asking about it. Shout out to Emma and to Ariana, who I bumped into and we're talking to about this. It's dedicated to everybody on Twitter who shared with such good grace my mid-review of Midnights. Shout out to the person who sent me a picture of a noose. That was fire. And thank you for returning me to the catalog of Lil Loaded, which I also appreciate. Let's get it cracking. This is not a great Taylor Swift album. I'm just putting it out there. I'm camera on today in the red jersey, tour merch, extremely rare. I have a lot of Swift ephemera. If anybody wants to go fund me for the Papa John's box, pizza box from this era, I'd be certainly game to have some contributions to that. Taylor is a generational artist. We all know that. That said, this feels stuck in place. I do have some theories about that, some of which I talked about in my review. LZ, talk to me. Where are you at on Midnights? That's right. Yeah, we're thrown right to you.
I mean,
I would make a baseball joke, but I don't know anything about sports.
That's okay. Yeah, I will refrain.
Thank you.
Stuck in place, use it. Stasis is a word that's been coming up for me. I don't know that that is a bad thing, though. I think this record has grown on me the more I listen to it. And I agreed with a lot of your review, John, that I think we need to talk about the way the project of re-recording her albums has sort of made the new music that she's making feel more backwards glancing and more self-referential than ever. I think there's a real Hall of Mirrors quality to this record that is both a strength and a limitation at the same time. It is very much a record in conversation with her older songs. She's literally sampling Out of the Woods on one of these songs, which is a song that's not even 10 years old in her catalog yet. So I really see her like looking backwards in this way that I do find interesting as a fan, but I find a little limiting to this music breaking out beyond like people who are very interested in Taylor Swift, of which there are many, many millions, apparently. I mean, we also have to talk about how this record is set to be like the commercial smash of the year. It's breaking records that she previously held with Reputation, which I know for everyone but John Caramonica in the world sort of think there's a public perception that that record was sort of some sort of failure, but it was a huge commercial success.
Vindication.
So I think this record is really hitting in ways that even Folklore and Lover did not in a commercial sense. And part of that has to do with the rollout. But I think come year end time and as we're kind of looking at what happened this year, like the story of this record is going to be very big in the industry and the trends that it both forecasts and exploits in a way.
And shout out our friends at Hits Daily Double, who I'm sure are going to adequately cover all the business components of this. JP, where are you at on Midnights?
Well, to me, it's the first record where she's actively doubled back. She's going back to Reputation. She's going back to 1989. She's revisiting a style that she's already moved through. Lindsay said it's an echo chamber. It's a hall of mirrors. She's done this stuff before. Should we get very conspiracy theory right up front? Could this be the Missing Karma album?
That's the, you know, the Reddits are Redditing. The Tumblrs are tumbling.
She has already semi-debunked. So she said that these are all new songs. So take that as you will.
That is also what was shared with me. Now, look, narrativizers are going to narrativize, you know? I will say one of the challenges of this record in terms of the doubling back is I feel like if it's doubling back to one moment, it's doubling back to Lover. I know other people see other things or hear other things, but Lover to me is maybe the least tonally consistent and least successful of the pre-Folklore albums, the canonical pre-Folklore albums. And one of the things that I really struggled with on this record, and Joe, you had shared that YouTube kid who was just like guessing if Jack Antonoff produced the songs based on the first like 3 seconds of the vocal production. This is something, I mean, we talk about doubling back to an idea or doubling down on an idea. This particular textural approach, which to be frank, by the 8th time listening to this album, I was like, are we on a, like a James Blake type beat? Like what are we doing here? To me, it didn't seem like a insertion of rebar into concrete to make it stronger. It seemed like a kind of like we are 3D model printing a thing that already exists.
Wow, that was a crazy construction metaphor. I need to go back and listen to that.
First of all, you can't see my HGTV stand-up. That's really where my stand-up energy is being spent these days.
It's true.
Joe, does this record hit different in California, Joe?
I've been on the move this week and I haven't been in the skies. It doesn't, you know, when I received Folklore, I was remembering back, I was on vacation, I listened to it in a thunderstorm, it was perfect scenario wise and you guys had the opposite experience, and I think that continues to play out in our reception of those records. This one hit me at a very strange moment. I've had a busy week, I've been on the move, I haven't been in a position
rap
to
capital
really
in stores
it.
Now
yeah, thank you. Yeah. Yeah, by the book. So we can continue doing Taylor Swift podcasts
literally
till the
like,
end of
like
time.
Actually.
And honestly, until this Sunday morning, I feel like I hadn't understood this album. I will say, you know, play 6, play 7 through, I'm starting to get it more, especially side A. I find the middle and side B just still exceeding my grasp. But I do... I don't know.
That's like, a generous phrasing.
Yeah.
It's a
okay.
Generous phrasing.
Here's really where I'm at. I'm starting to divide Taylor Swift albums into singer-songwriter Taylor Swift albums and singing-to-track pop star Taylor Swift albums. And this is not science. I know she's a singer-songwriter through and through, but these don't play to me as songs written on piano or guitar. And I know some of Folklore was her singing to Dessner tracks. But there's a real element of her trying to fit herself around things. Specifically, what I'm struggling with on this album are the melodies and the verse melodies in particular. She has this run-on flow that she uses on certain Jack Antonoff productions. And this goes back to 1989, which has never clicked for me. I think it's my least favorite Taylor Swift album, which I know is controversial. And when the moments hit that are pure Taylor Swift, like the song we listened to coming in, You're On Your Own, Kid, to me, that is real, capital T-S, Taylor Swift.
That's why I opened with it. Even though I don't think it's the best song on the record, it is a Taylor Swift, no quote marks, a Taylor Swift song.
And the difference between her pushing herself to me in directions I don't really want her to go and when she's really in her pocket. And it's not even about the good stuff sounding like the old stuff. It just is of her and it has a authenticity to it that you feel comfortable in her songwriting. And there are verses where half of the verse to me is failing and half of the verse is working. And there's a lot of that on this album and I can't go all the way there. And I really felt like she and Jack had hit on something new in the Folklore era. Songs like Mirrorball, August, This Is Me Trying, Gold Rush, My Tears Ricochet, Illicit Affairs, like to me, those are some of the best songs she's ever created. And I thought she had moved past her need for Jack Antonoff productions. And then those came out and I thought maybe they'd hit a new gear. And I agree, this feels like a swerve and it's not always successful.
Can I play a song that I think has some of the drawing within the lines vocally that maybe you're referring to? To me, that Question is a song like this. Certainly the beginning of Question. Also, strangely, Dan Adler's favorite song.
Interesting.
Shout out Dan. Let's listen to a little bit of Question.
Can I ask you a question? Did you ever have someone kiss you in a crowded room? And every single one of your friends was making fun of you. But 15 seconds later, they were clapping too.
hate this song. I'm sorry.
Yeah, well, I struggled with this song. And I struggled with this song because my favorite lyric on this song, which comes early in the song, I read it on the lyric sheet. And then if you would have asked me like where the word break was, like where the line break was, I would have gotten it wrong 5 times in a row, which is I don't remember who I was before you painted all my nights a color I have searched for since. And it doesn't break where I think it's supposed to break. It doesn't feel, the rhythm doesn't feel quite right. Karen, you say you are opposed to question. Frankly, I saw on Instagram, which you're not opposed to, extremely sus. Why don't you just tell everybody? I mean, you already told the people follow you on Instagram. Why don't you just tell everyone else?
I think it's a mid album as well, but the songs that I like, I really, really like. And I'm just going to completely pretend that the 3 a.m. songs don't exist because those are seven songs I don't like at all. So I'm just going to talk about it.
Attractive.
I'm just going to talk about the 10 tracks, of which I really do like 6 of them, possibly 7. No, look, we're going to go with 6.
It's 13, just to...
Oh my God, it's 13.
Yeah, of course.
that lowers my percentage. I told them I was doing math before this began. This is why I don't do math for a living. My God, you're right. Of course it's 13. I knew that. Anyway.
Brown University in the house.
Listen, there's no requirements, and I didn't take any math. I think that's showing right now.
Sorry, should I go get my math team jacket just for the rest of the episode?
John, math team is getting up there with a semester in London for the podcast drinking game.
That's right.
But I agree with everything that you guys said about the tone and the tenor and the shape of the album. It does feel like a return most to Lover to me. But then when I went back and listened to Lover, it had many different shifts and aesthetics. And it's one specific element of Lover that it's sort of hitting that over and over again. I went back and I listened to Reputation yesterday and I was like, God, part of the thrill of Reputation is that there's so many different colors. And every song, you really had no idea where she was going to go.
And it was so like, quote unquote, wrong that you're like, damn, she did something wrong, quote unquote, wrong. I mean, I love this record. She did something bad, but so feels so good.
But it felt very good. Yes. Yeah.
And that is, you know, the kind of frisson of that is what makes Reputation like beyond a great album, but kind of like an album that I think other pop stars could look to as a mode for them.
But when I went back to Reputation, I really liked 12 of the 15 songs. Now I'm concerned about my math, so God knows if I have that right. But and Lover, I liked 13 of 18.
Oh, wow. You really did math. Yeah.
Yes, I did.
Crunch your numbers.
I did, which gives me a personal, so it's a 72 on Lover and an 80 for Reputation.
We're going Metacritic.
No,
I just divided and multiplied to make it out of 100. I was just curious to see my own view.
I'm getting a 50 tattoo on my arm.
But I mean, the things that work here really, really work. And the songs that I like the most are Anti-Hero. I'm beyond thrilled that this is the first single. I'm like literally jumping
Taylor Swift
up and down.
Single. She hasn't hit with a single like this probably since Delicate, you know, RIP to the prospects of Cruel Summer. But like, this is, to me, it's Blank Space Part 2. It's really, really, really peak radio Taylor. Like this is a hit.
Could not agree more. Everything is just so aligned perfectly and lyrically. And then after that, I do love You're On Your Own, Kid, which I know, John, you had some issues with the vocals.
I've like warmed a little bit to it. But yeah, I don't like love it, but it has softened a little bit towards it.
And the one that I think that you're viewing is controversial, but I am not, is Karma. Which I'm waiting for people's faces. Well, how do you all not like this song? It's the song is amazing. Can we
all
listen
right,
to
play,
it?
No. Let's let the people judge. We're going to play a little bit of Karma. And Pedro, you can even play like the good parts of Karma, wherever they are. You can go find them.
What does that mean?
This is Karma. Karen, I don't want to be one of those podcasts that's like, defend Karma.
Why are you not having fun with this? You know, I mean, this is... I think the track itself is one of the more fun, upbeat tracks on the album. It sounds different than the other ones in a way. It's crisper.
This is a Soundwave track, yeah?
Yeah, sparklier in a good way.
As someone texted me, who shall remain nameless, why she got to bring Soundwave into this?
Soundwave, best known for his work with Kendrick Lamar. Former Taylor Swift collaborator, Kendrick Lamar.
Yes,
that's right.
Yes, and also Soundwave was on London Boy, perhaps my if not my least favorite song in the Taylor Swift oeuvre, like certainly like a bottom 10 song.
Up there with absolutely up there or down there with Me.
Oh God.
Oh, it's worse than Me.
And is it?
Me is no. Yes. Yeah. And Me is not it.
I
want to
hear JP
than
talk about Karma, because I think he's the. I think we're. I'm lightly with Karen that I don't quite understand what this song is about. I don't know what Karma is my boyfriend means.
Why do you have to? Why can't it just be fun?
I'm fine with that, but I want JP to cast the deciding vote on Karma.
Well, I kind of know exactly what it's about. It's about classic Taylor Swift. It's about revenge. It's about, you know, it's going to come back on you. Taylor Swift writes a lot of songs that obviously start with a title or a concept. I'm going to write about karma. I'm going to write about how I'm going to get the last laugh. Maroon, which is not one of my favorite songs on this album, also is like, oh, the color maroon. Doesn't that go with burgundy? You know, you can just see the self-assignment wheels clicking. Karma isn't just one of the more upbeat songs on the album. It's one of the few upbeat songs on the album. So it's such a relief when it arrives. But I do think it's a song written to a concept instead of a song that arose out of, you know, that mysterious, impressionistic, imagistic process.
I'm actually really glad you said that, because it's worth taking a bit of a step back. Following Midnight's an album that I think is an insufficient album lyrically. Why do we feel that way? Because Karen, cover your ears. If Katy Perry had put these songs out, I'd probably be like, these are fine, you know? But we're talking about Taylor Swift, who is genuinely one of the sharpest storytelling pop singer-songwriters of the last 20 years. Someone who has made a huge career out of taking intense emotional moments, rendering them with narrative detail, and exploding them onto like grand pop stages. So if that's how you're coming into a record like Midnight's, knowing that that's possible, and then you bump into a song like Karma, it feels sus.
I want to address that, but zooming back into Karma, which I am team, this is a bad song.
That's why I knew JP was the deciding vote, because I could see Lindsay's face.
Yeah, I was just seething.
And but so JP voted against you and I, Karen. Sorry.
Well, I have two things to say about it. One is that, to go back to the sort of Karma album conspiracy theory that JP brought up before, my take on that is that it wasn't an album, or maybe it was, but I think this song could have been written in the Reputation era, and the sort of wink to the fans is like, this is an old song that I'm bringing back, because it feels of a piece just perspective wise and songwriting wise. But that also, like, for a songwriter as talented as Taylor Swift, like, that shouldn't be, like, I shouldn't be questioning, is this a leftover from 6 years ago that she just didn't put on a record? Like, it shouldn't feel like that to me. And I think another reason that this song doesn't work for me, and kind of alludes to what John was saying before, that there's become a sort of excess and a sloppiness to some of her lyric writing that I think, going off what you were saying, Joe, of like the way that her flow on the Antonoff productions, like there's something run on and kind of ceaseless about it. And as someone who knows how succinct she can be as a songwriter, like I feel like one of the most succinct, brilliant Taylor Swift lines from Mine is, you know, you made a rebel of a careless man's careful
daughter.
Yeah,
I mean, that's incredible.
That is succinct
incredible
storytelling.
Nothing on this album, even within 5 football fields.
Pulitzer quality.
No, like she's mixing metaphors. I think in that song, like, it's karma is this, karma is that. And it's all these things that like don't feel that precise. She's throwing all these metaphors at the wall in these songs, and some of them stick and some of them are really quotable. But I miss that concision in her songwriting. I miss that sense of really laboring over a lyric that feels crafted and kind of polished down, and not just like every idea. And I do wonder if some of that is moving from collaborating with other songwriters like Liz Rose, like
Drink,
who from the early days, yeah, moving to collaborating more with a producer like Antonoff. The whole point of Jack Antonoff as a producer, as we see with his work with Lana Del Rey or even with Lorde, they have lyrical perspectives. I think while Taylor is, like we said, a generational songwriter, an amazing talent, I think she is someone that sometimes could benefit from collaboration on a songwriting
and being pushed, like be like
being pushed and being edited in the right places too. And I don't think that that's something that Antonoff can offer his artists. And I think that's part of why you get this narrative of the ambivalence about what he's able to sort of get out of them. And I think someone like Lana is really good at bringing all these ideas, knowing how to edit her own, you know, just getting some real like poetry out of that approach. And I think a lot of my ambivalence with the Jack Antonoff productions, which it sounds like we all kind of share, is I don't know that he's pushing back or challenging her from a pure lyric perspective. And I miss that in her music.
I don't even think it's a question of, is he pushing back or challenging her? It's more that the end point of the Antonoff productions feels preordained. And it's like they're both showing up to deliver the preordained thing. I mean, this is like, obviously, if you follow hip hop, you understand about tight beat production. You go on YouTube, it's like any major producer, so-and-so tight beats, you know, some kid in like Cyprus is making records that sound exactly like Kendrick Lamar records. These songs, this vocal production is Jack Antonoff type beat vocal production. And it just happens to be done by Jack Antonoff. And that's a struggle. And like I said, that kid on YouTube we were talking about, and I hate that it had to be him, but it's true. That's it's absolutely what's happening here. And I think, JP, you mentioned that like a song like Karma feels like it's an idea before it's a lyric. It's an idea before it's a fully constructed song. I would say the vast majority of songs on this album, it's almost as if they knew what they were intended to sound like and then merely kind of like drew within those lines rather than did something spontaneous that could potentially spiral in a different direction.
And yet there are sounds on this album that are really good. There are tracks that are really good and there are vocal moments that are really good and they don't always go together. Think about an Antihero, like after the Everybody Agrees is at the bridge and then the new synth comes in. Like Jack is doing some cool stuff in the mix here. Or even like the post-chorus little Christmas music-y thing in Antihero. Also the little sleigh bells that come in. Like there are nice textural touches.
A lot of Christmas music on
there is. There is. But Taylor's been, she's been circling Christmas music for a while.
Yeah, but didn't you have the conspiracy theory that Evermore was supposed to be a Christmas album?
I mean, Tis the Damn Season, I think still just a killer. It's funny you mention the Jack stuff. I know, you know, people resist the idea of putting that he is somehow controlling all of these women and putting them in his box. But something that his records with Lana, Lorde, this Taylor album, and even that the latest Claro album, Sling, have is a lack of rhyme and these run-on sentences, and they're very verbose. And I don't know what it is. I think maybe it's that his tracks are quite bespoke. They're not pop song loops. They live and breathe and grow as they go on. And I think there's something about that that invites these vocalists and these songwriters to try to sprawl with him, to try to unfurl their thoughts. And I think it doesn't always work.
I'd love to know which came first. I'd love to know, is the lyric package coming first? We should listen to that bit of Antihero. Because I don't, again, it's possible for a person who is a good songwriter to write mid songs, a person who's a good producer to have a narrow approach to production in a particular context. But let's listen to a good stretch of Jack Antonoff stuff. So this little bridgey part in Antihero, let's listen to that.
Everybody agrees.
Karen, I know you were chomping at the bit to get in on this.
No, I just wanted to defend Karma one more time. I'm sorry, I don't want to go backwards, but it's like, do we think that Out of the Woods is a lyrically brilliant Taylor Swift song? And yet it still is a great song. The issue here is that there is no Getaway Car and there is no Miss Americana and the Heartbreak Prince on this record. You don't need to, you know, sling your arrows at Karma just because we're missing something.
That is not why I'm slinging arrows at Karma. I'm slinging arrows at Karma because it's type goofy. Like it's beneath her. I'm sorry.
You're allowed we can have fun. Give us fun. But I am missing one of those more deeply constructed.
I want to have fun. I'll listen to Bandman Rill. Like I'm good. It's type goofy. It's literally like, look.
I can tell you what's goofy. Question is goofy. Bejeweled is goofy.
Bejeweled is the most Lovercore song
Bejeweled's
on
not
here.
Goofy. It's not goofier than Karma.
It is.
Yeah, they are of a piece.
But it's the same thing. I want to write a song called Bejeweled. Let me put all of my jewelry metaphors into a song. It's very much a construction project.
I want to zoom in for a second on Maroon, because I think Maroon is one that is both backwards looking. It's very self-referential. She already has a song called Red. You know, she's already spoken about this color family. She's done that across her discography now. And I think that Maroon has a lot of great moments and a lot of bad moments. And sometimes, like I said, like totally like slammed together, like to me, like a line like you were standing hollow eyed in the hallway, the way she delivers that and with the alliteration, like peak Swift. And then the very next line, carnations you had thought were roses, that's us, like all sort of jumbled together. And the first verse, the incense, the vinyl shelf, I like all of that.
The cheap ass screw top rosé.
Yeah. Oh, that like,
shout out White Lightning.
Then you get to the chorus and there's all this space and she's really using the production and landing the chorus. And the outro, to me, when she drops the octave on the hook on the outro, like one of the best moments on the album, these songs are a lot, so many of them are almost there. Even Lavender Haze, like pretty experimental for a Taylor Swift song. Shout out to Zoe Kravitz, who's been working.
Shout out to Maggie Rogers,
who's been working on an album with Jack, I guess. And maybe this came from those sessions. I don't know. Soundwave on this one. But then you have the bridge. And it's just like for Taylor and Jack specifically, known for their construction of killer bridges. Talk your talk and go viral. Like, and the way it's delivered, like, it's just like.
She didn't write that one.
It's a mess.
I'm not crazy about get this off my desk either. I don't know.
Okay, so yeah. I feel like Taylor did not write that line. Wait, first of all, let's take a quick break. Let's listen to a little bit of Lavender Haze. And then we're going to come back and get involved in this. Okay, before we pick the conversation back up, just something that has been on people's minds for a long time that I wanted to touch on and make a small announcement about. The email, the DMs, the Facebook messages that I get the most ask about shirts. And you know what? We made some shirts. We're going to give the money to charity. It's thepopcast.myshopify.com. They're available now. If you came to the live show, we had a few there. Also, at my closet sale, LOL. We had a few there, but we haven't put them out widely. Now they are available. Please go grab one. It's thepopcast.myshopify.com. All the profits going to the New York Times Neediest Cases Fund, which is a charity that the paper runs for more than 100 years. Incredible cause. And I'm excited to get them in your hands. And they only exist because you guys have emailed and been so generous and excited to have one. So here we are. Now, back to the convo. We're back on the Midnight's Cast. JP is here. Lindsay is here. Karen Gans, a.k.a. Ganscore, is here. Joe Baldwin, a.k.a. Joey Blogs, a.k.a. Joe Coscarelli, is here. I've been thinking a lot about the children of Taylor Swift. And if Taylor were
the sexy
to...
babies.
I was going to say, you mean the sexy babies.
I didn't say that.
I can't. We went 31 minutes without saying sexy baby. I just
first of all, and we're going to go 60 minutes without me saying it for the record. So I've been thinking a lot about the children of Taylor Swift. And if Taylor were to kind of like reverse borrow, what was the thing that she did? The Phoebe Bridgers thing? Am I remembering this correctly?
Yeah, the song.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Where it's like, kind of like, you come down to my house and you done a, but yeah, she's going to reverse borrow.
Nothing new.
That yes. Always feels like, that has felt to me like the kind of world of folks that she should be drawing upon. There is some borrowing on this album that does not feel like it's from a natural inheritor of Taylor Swift. To the point, Maggie Rogers, I know, Lindsay, you also very much heard the Maggie Rogers on Lavender Haze. Mm-hmm. It's interesting to hear Taylor attempting this kind of like Moncay Drake stuff in the mix. And I sort of, a very strange in 2022, there's a version, and again, I talked about this on Instagram a little bit, but there's like a version of like 2015 or 2016, the two of them get in a room and crank out 10 of the best songs you've ever heard in your entire life. And that album like changes the actual course of pop music history. Whatever this is not
Imagine
that.
Lavender Haze without the bridge, but you just hear Drake say, yeah, and then do whatever he's going to do. You know, like there's exactly. It's almost there. Almost there.
But there's probably like three or four moments on the album that if another pop star did them, I would say that's whack that you like listened to Drake 10 years ago and then like sort of did like a light rip. With Taylor making this choice, it just seems baffling to me, especially when of all people, she could pick up the phone and make that call and actually do something really, really provocative and interesting. Also, the pitch her shifted loss. Vocals. The
that's kind all of, I'll say.
Her loss. Exactly. Coming soon. So the pitch shifted vocals where she's like in dialogue with herself. There's, you know, to me, there's an echo of that. And then the anti-hero video where different versions of Taylor are kind of in conversation with herself. What do we make of the choices of other sounds that she's choosing to kind of incorporate or retroactively bring onto her palette?
I think they feel, for the most part, like disappointingly 5 to 10 years ago. I think you pointed this out in your review, John, that I don't hear her in any sense like looking towards the future on this record. And that's both in the way it's doubling back on her own meta past, which I do kind of like in a way, but sonically, that's more the problem for me, that it sounds like...
It sounds like Dress.
Yeah, or it sounds... A vibe I was getting a lot was Pure Heroine, the first Lord album, the one that Jack Antonoff did not produce, which is kind of interesting. But that's also, like you're saying, these were in some ways someone like Lord or even Maggie Rogers in a sense. Like these are the inheritors of what Taylor Swift was doing earlier in her career. And it is a little disconcerting to hear her then tapping into the sounds of the people who were initially inspired by her. I think sonically it just feels stuck and feels a little dated. I also like really can't stand all the pitch shifted vocals on this. That just feels so 10 years ago.
Forget whether it's au courant or not. Like put that to the side. Is there a philosophy? Like let's listen to Midnight Rain, which has some of this on it, I think. Midnight Rain?
That's yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Okay.
A lot of
let's
it.
Let's listen to a little bit of Midnight Rain. You wanted it comfortable, I wanted that pain. You wanted a bride, I was making my own name. Chasing that fame, you stayed the same. All of me changed like midnight. It came like a postcard. Picture perfect, shiny family, holiday. Is there a philosophy at work here? Why couldn't she just call someone else to do the vocal? What is she trying to say in the down-pitched vocals that she can't say at normal pitch? What's happening here?
I do have a theory on that particular one. Like, that's the only instance of the pitch-shifted vocals that feel a little meaningful to me in the thematics of the song. Like, I think we should be talking a bit, too, about the sort of topics that she's addressing on this record, a lot of which are ambivalence about this perception that she is going to get married and have a family and is going to follow a certain path that was laid out for how a woman is supposed to be successful. That
R.I.P. Jill Alwyn, you put in all this labor only to get subslagged on this album.
This is a bit Don't Worry, Darling, the album.
Yeah.
Wow.
Oof, just going to leave that right there.
Let's have an Antonoff pause after that.
I think I'm on to something, but continue.
You're calling it? You calling
I
it now?
I like this.
You Babe
like
Ruth? This. You doing this? You Babe Ruth it to the right field wall? All right.
There's some Olivia Wilde feminism going on, I think, in that song. But aside from the production on Midnight Rain, I find that song thematically to be really compelling. And again, I like, as someone who is deep enough in her catalog to get all the meta references that she's making and stuff, I find the way that she's sort of gone back to her past songs, her past way of presenting this idea of romance and love and the love story that ends with the marriage proposal or something. She's really teasing out an ambivalence about that later in her career and like complicating this kind of fairy tale idea that she was so persistent and propagating like when she was a teenager. And I find that compelling. Again, I think there's limitations to that because you have to be really versed in her history to get the way that she's playing with that past. But I hear the pitch shifting in that song almost taking on this like masculine quality that she's playing around. She mentions politics and gender roles on another song. Like I do see her engaging with that in a way that's like a little bit more explicit on this record than she ever has.
you were looking for zingers from this album. You weren't looking for the great line. I mean, in Lavender Haze, she sets it out. She says, the only kind of girl Lacey is a one night or a wife. It's pretty direct, asking me if I'm going to be a bride.
But it seems like something she could have said 5 or even 7 years ago.
I do think her relationship with Joe Alwyn, even though he's, you know,
Bill Bowery. I think you're misattributing to Bill Bowery.
Bill Bowery. The songwriter, Bill
the
Bowery.
Noted songwriter, Bill Bowery.
The soon-to-be Grammy-nominated songwriter, Bill Bowery, certainly.
Can't wait for the speech.
But, like, I was thinking about this, too, with Lavender Haze, of, you know, this idea that the tabloid attention that used to be paid to her boyfriends and her, you know, various relationships and who's she dating now. I do think in some ways a version of that fixation has become, are they secretly married? Are they engaged? We saw her wearing a ring. That energy has now focused on this one relationship that she's been in, the longest relationship of her life, I think. It's been like 6 years now that they've been together, I believe. He was the muse of Reputation in some ways too. So like she's been now in what seems like a very stable and supportive relationship for the past 4 or 5 albums. And used to sort of get this songwriting material out of various short-lived relationships. So I think that there's
you're
a
saying
way
we
in
want
which,
the Mary J. Blige version of Taylor is what you're saying. Just say
yes. Yeah.
Damn.
No, I do.
That's so rude.
I do want more drama, though. I do want more drama.
That's rude and unfeminist and rude.
Part of my frustration with a lot of the songs on this album, I feel like they are relitigating the public relationships that she's already litigated on prior albums. So I think that Midnight Rain is part of that. That's very frustrating. Yeah.
Not to do the total Us Weekly stuff, but the one where she's like, he wanted a wife and I was making my own name.
That's Midnight Rain.
No, that's Midnight Rain. Okay, that's a Hiddleston song to me. I think she mentions a holiday. Remember the 4th of July party shirt?
Wait, that's not the Gyllenhaal song? Isn't there a Gyllenhaal song on there too?
Oh, you think that's a Gyllenhaal song? No.
I felt like the one with the New York socks, whatever thing, isn't that a Gyllenhaal song?
Oh,
can I take an unpopular position here?
Yeah.
What's you that, JP?
I don't care. Yeah. I'm so sick. I'm sick of the meta narrative. I'm sick of the fan service. I'm sick of it. Please write songs.
Yeah.
You know,
but
don't
that's
address
what Folklore
your...
was. And Folklore was good. I know this is a controversial opinion on this, but JP, I know you're
I'm
with
about
me.
About to
on
mute
this.
You.
Like, I'm with you, Joe.
That is
about to mute you.
Like Taylor Swift brought everything together that she's good at, and she wrote songs that are not about Taylor Swift TM.
I co-sign this entirely.
Me too.
Yes.
Me too.
Yes.
Joe, me and you, Folklore girlfriend, Reputation boyfriend. That's all I have to say.
It's true. It's true.
That's all I have to say. Literally,
I want to pull back a sec from speaking of our own meta narrative. We reference Metacritic. We reference, John, the hate mail you've gotten for the last couple of Taylor Swift albums for writing.
Big dox boy.
They doxed you. They threatened to dox you over and over again. We're in this moment of knee-jerk anointing of classics. We have music publications out here saying immediately upon this album
say
dropping
it louder for the publications
that
it
is perfect. And the fans expect everyone to fall in line and say that this album is perfect. I just want to say we love Taylor Swift as an artist. We consider everything she does individually on its own terms as part of the whole. I don't think we could take her more seriously. And I think like if you consider your artists to be, as we've said, generational talents, the most important people making popular culture, like let's think and talk about these people in a real way. Like we are not stan communities. Like we need John's review of this album.
We love you, Joe. And you're totally right.
Some of these other reviews are so embarrassing. They're so embarrassing. And you all should be ashamed of yourself.
Number one, big facts. Okay, I want to add a couple things to that. One, we don't like Taylor Swift for clout. Number two, we don't critique Taylor Swift for clout. That's not what this is. This is not about clout. And I only say that, not that anybody that we know would ever think that, but I think that there is like certainly a universe on my Instagram comments that thinks that that's how these things function in the world. And I hope when they grow up and reach something past 18, they'll understand that that's not the case. That's number one. Number two, I wanted to read something. Look, we talk a lot about the role of criticism and art on podcasts. We've had entire episodes dedicated to it. We talk about it when we critique the artists that we love and we care about. I wanted to read a couple of tweets from someone who just like really distilled it very cleanly. This is from Rain Fisher Kwan, who is a young writer who is extremely astute on internet culture. And Rain wrote, "I promise if professional music critics are scared to review an artist's work, because any realistic criticism, even in a positive review, could result in death threats or doxing, you are not doing your favorite artist any favors. You are actively impeding their ability to make good art. You are insulting them, and you are insulting yourselves, and you are obviously insulting the critics who do an essential service for the art world. You deserve respect as a consumer. You are more than a sentient income stream that exists to drive merch sales and boost numbers."
Amen. That is, like, well, that is what I'm saying. Like,
yep. Effing yep. men.
You are doing true more spit to burnish Taylor Swift's artistic legacy than somebody who is just throwing 5 stars at her. Serious five artists stars. Need to be considered seriously. And it's not happening. And it's not only with Taylor Swift. Obviously, it's not only with Taylor Swift, but it gets to be, it's the worst with Taylor Swift.
Yes, the apex. Yeah.
As they say on the internet, a lot of y'all could learn something from this.
There's a specific tenor of the conversation about this record, too, that I think in some ways, because Folklore and Evermore were surprise releases and there wasn't like a time to like get ready at midnight, let's all listen to the new Taylor Swift record. And also because I think Lover and Reputation to some extent were received a little more mixed or had more complicated narratives coming in. There is just a tenor to this conversation of just, let me generate all the memes about why this record is the greatest thing of all time. And it feels particularly heightened with this record. I do think it is, like I said at the top, though, it's like translating into a level of chart success that she's not experienced in a while. And I think that's worth looking at, too. This record is on track to move
more than a million units.
Wild amount. Yeah.
Which like, is, yeah, which we thought we'd never see again.
And the rest of this year has been extremely stagnant on the charts. We've talked about this a bit, but the only thing that's really hit before this has been Bad Bunny. Harry Styles, did that come out this year?
Yeah.
It's Bad Bunny, it's Harry Styles, it's Morgan Wallen. Beyonce, you know, not as, obviously not as major in this conversation, but she opened high and she's been hanging in there. But that's it. It's really not been, you know, there were all these giant albums. We thought Kendrick was going to be big. We thought Post Malone was going to be big.
Even the Drake record did not do what it was supposed to do, or at least in my mind, what it could have done. Okay, there are two songs we really haven't talked about a lot, and both are I think, fascinating for completely different reasons. Let's talk about something that's weird but beautiful. Snow on the Beach.
No.
Are we falling like snow?
Was the lost Lana Del Rey verse, as someone on Twitter said, stolen when her backpack was stolen out of her car on Melrose
That's
Avenue?
That's the most compelling conspiracy I've heard yet.
I actually think this is a perfect use of Lana Del Rey. I'm in a...
What?
No. I think she is such good texture on this song. I think the backup vocals, the little post-chorus thing, I have no problem with the use. Oh, we all love
having
Lana
sun exposure.
In our way.
Your sun exposure.
I think
there.
This is a weird song in general, but I have no problem with the way that Lana is used here as a shade.
Can we talk about the distribution of labor on this song? Not simply the singing, which obviously the memes about Lana being like trapped in a cage, gagged and bound while Taylor sings her lyrics. Obviously, there's oodles of those memes, which are all very funny. As far as the pure lyric writing, what percent of the lyric writing do we feel is Lana on this? Because I feel like on more than a few moments, I'm really hearing Taylor singing a lot, what I identify as a Lana rhythm in the sort of syllabic rhythm sense.
I think it's possible that she is doing Lana, but not literally doing Lana.
She's trying to write a Lana Del Rey song.
Yes. Oh, that's what you think. Dear John, but
yes.
with someone she likes.
And then you probably get her coming around on the back end when she says, oh, I wrote this like in Lana mode. We might as well just get her on it. But I have no idea. Pure speculation, but I think it's more that
I just prefer to think that they like met up at Jack's house or something. They happen to be there on the same day and we're just
there's
like,
a photo.
We have to do this.
Yeah.
But I'm saying like, I like to think that as an origin story that's sort of, that it came from that.
I have like a related question that I think comes up on this record and specifically in this song, which I've gone from in Folklore era being like absolutely thrilled that Taylor Swift was like dropping F-bombs and had incorporated cursing into her language. Like, I've just followed that very closely. I love that development. I think it's come to be a bit of a lyrical crutch on this record.
Yeah.
It's not that it offends my delicate sensibilities for her to call Snow on the Beach weird but f-ing beautiful, but it's just
gratuitous.
We were talking about that lost concision or that lost specificity on some of these lyrics. And I do think in a weird way, she's come to rely on not necessarily the shock value of a lyric like that, but that it's assuming that that's conversational and that's how people talk, when lyrically the song does not really work for me. And I think the chorus just relies a little too much on that simile.
It's a little bit of like an AI or a DALL-E kind of like, this is how humans speak. Like, here's the
Yeah.
There were some good tweets about being over Taylor cursing and sort of the gratuitousness. And I strongly support all those tweets.
Okay. Absolutely. The most old school Lana moment in here that I think you're right could just be, now that I think about it, Lana written. Now I'm all for you, like Janet. Can this be a real thing?
1,000%.
Like, that is Taylor writing.
Yeah. I can't tell if Taylor wrote that.
Is that Taylor writing as Lana?
No.
Or is that Lana writing for Taylor?
That's Lana.
I think it's Taylor writing for Lana.
I think it's a Lana line. I was texting someone about that who shared the video of Janet like vibing to it and seeing like Janet. I was like, Janet would not approve of this. And then Janet put the video out and said, and this person said, oh, look, like Janet approves. And I was like, ma'am, this is a hostage situation.
Wait, is it like real or it's a mashup? Janet actually put up a video. I didn't see it.
I think it's real.
Okay. All right.
Yeah. I mean, I thought it was 90% sure it's real. I mean, unless it too is AI, but no, I think it's real. But it really does feel like if you are an older star and a younger person kind of like references you, it is now kind of de rigueur to be like, I'm going to go on TikTok and like nod very pensively and appreciatively. Yep. But no, that's a hostage situation. I don't know if it's genuine. Who can
this
say?
This is the whole meta narrative that Taylor Swift seems trapped in, that she escaped in folklore and is now back in this social media arena. I want to send her a memo saying, Taylor, don't read the comments.
That's right. Talk that talk.
She's definitely reading the comments. We haven't talked much about the second half of this album in bits and pieces, but
yeah, we have Bejeweled, Karma.
But I want to talk about Labyrinth, which I think is a true dud. I want to talk about Mastermind, and I want to talk about Sweet Nothing. I think Sweet Nothing is up there with some of Taylor's best ballads. I think it really, I think it really
song.
Works. And I think the production works.
Bill Bowery went
Wait, can
off.
I say something funny about Sweet Nothing that Karen and I got into in the edit?
Yeah.
I think that there is a rhythm in the singing that is like a shanty-esque rhythm, and Karen would not let me have it. She wouldn't let me have it. I had to change it to Lullaby.
But like, Yeah.
But like, I still low-key stand by that. Anyway, please continue.
Not a shanty.
I think the Sweet Nothing lyric gets back to concise country Taylor Swift.
Mm-hmm.
It's the vocal production. Doug, it's the fact that it's the only song that's not like seven stacked Taylors like squeezing each other to death.
But also the
play
on words. The play on words of hearing your sweet nothings, all you ever wanted me from me was nothing. You know, like that is...
That's Bill Bowery.
Bill Bowery
in your ear.
Did that. But all right, what about Mastermind? Because Mastermind, again, is like, it almost has the countrified Taylor twist, right? Because the third chorus switches perspectives. Like, she hasn't done that in a while, or not as consistently. But it doesn't land for me. And I think it's going back to JP complaining about the meta narrative. It's too much about Taylor Swift as professional dater.
I talked about this in the review about Taylor Swift versus Taylor Swift in quotes and her responding to public perception of her or to the widely perceived character. I do think is good raw material for her. It's as good as whatever emotional or dating stuff that she dealt with so effectively on the early albums. I like the writing on Mastermind. Like, Mastermind's one of the few songs that doesn't feel rushed. The whole album feels rushed. We've gotten very far into this episode without me saying what I think is the most fundamental critique of this record, which it feels like it was done fast. It does not feel like a sustained body of like hibernation, idea generation, idea development, idea delivery. It feels like, wow, we got to run for whatever reason.
When she released the seven more songs and she put out something where she said, you know, she really thinks of it as a concept album. Do any of you think that this actually works as a concept album? Because I don't.
I don't.
What's the concept?
The Midnight's concept, that they were late night thoughts.
The concept is it's a clock.
the concept.
The concept.
The concept.
It's not a concept.
No, yeah. The concept is I had to put out an album to boost ticket sales for the tour next year, but I could not put out songs that would violate the fundamental direction that the tour is going to take. That's the concept. Sorry. Forgive me.
Antihero is going to be great in a stadium.
Absolutely. I don't have a problem. I don't have a problem with that.
Yes.
As will Labyrinth.
I'm going to go get a hot dog and a pretzel when Karma comes.
Labyrinth too.
I want to hear you guys defend Labyrinth. It doesn't
I like Labyrinth. I like the whole like Phantom of the Opera church organ thing.
Kate Bush James Blake ass song.
Yeah, it is. I like the whole elevator metaphor.
Oh no, I don't like the elevator. That's one of these lines where I'm just like, where's the editor? It's not good Bowery enough to be a Taylor Swift.
Where's Bill
line?
Bowery? He's Bill Bowery from now on.
Okay, but wait, if we're going to mention the editor and all of the stuff that shouldn't be here, let's talk for at least 2 minutes about these seven extra songs because we haven't really been taking them seriously.
Must we?
Two minutes.
Let's listen to Glitch.
Yeah, Glitch is cool.
Glitch is a good example of a song that probably could have gone either in the Reputation era or in the Lover era. In the Reputation era, as just part of like a big tent, ambitious experimentation. In the Lover era of like, hey, we're throwing 10 different things at the wall and most of them are pretty good because we thought through each of the individual 10 things. Glitch, to me, of these seven songs is the best. Four of these songs literally should never have been released. Like, they're actively damaging to the Taylor Swift
brand.
But
that goes for most bonus tracks. I think we're holding Taylor bonus tracks to a higher standard than most because we actually listen to them. Bonus tracks are bad. Bonus tracks are fan service and streaming boosts. I agree, but I just don't think it's important. It's not the album. Bonus tracks are never good.
However, I think the bonus tracks on her re-recordings have been, at least on the Red re-recording, the Taylor's version of Red, we need to kind of unpack this too, just how incredibly prolific she's been in the past few years. You know, we haven't talked much about the re-recordings, but I think they fit into this record, both in the backwards glancing nature of the project, but also in how she's just like completely saturated the market and is still hitting all these milestones and streaming wise and stuff. And I definitely think the bonus tracks are mostly streaming filler a la a too long Drake album to go back to her, you know, imagined collaborator. But she's just now completely emptying the vaults and putting everything out there. I find it a little fatiguing as a fan, like to go through all these songs. I think I was appreciative that the record was only 13 songs long. And then we got this dump of the rest of them. And I think, you know, again, I think she's just in this mode of both looking back at her past, but also throwing everything out there, even the rough drafts. And
yeah,
I just
it's super
want,
serving the fans.
Yeah, but I want things to be a little more labored over. Like, you know, I agree with the idea that this record feels rushed. It doesn't feel like there was another pass given to some of these writings. That like there's a rough draft feel to a lot of it.
Dark Lane demos, Taylor Swift.
One thing she mentioned behind the scenes and about the creation that's interesting is, and that I had forgotten about, is that she said they made a lot of it while their partners were starring in a movie together. Have you guys seen the trailer for the Joe Alwyn, Margaret Qualley film?
Shout out Claire Denis.
Yeah, shout out Claire Denis, although maybe a rare misstep for the Queen based on that trailer. But I think that that's an interesting framing for this project when you think of your romantic partners making something together and you feeling almost like you have to do something like while they're busy together as like a compliment to, I don't know. It's a very strange dynamic and it'll make for an interesting page and a half in the Taylor Swift bio in like 25 years.
Wow.
Wait, I wanted to mention something about Glitch. To me, Glitch is almost a path forward in the same way that False God was almost a path forward. I think there's a lot of attempting to do False God over again on this album. Someone mentioned this to me in the DMs, Allison, I think, shout out to her, False God was something I'd never heard from Taylor, and it has some of the run on this. It has some of the coloring outside the lines. It has like a semi-futuristic production. I really think that she was trying to do a lot of that again here, and some of it works and some of it doesn't. But I think Glitch is in the same mode.
Are we avoiding a lawsuit? Let's do
y'all
that.
Y'all have stopped me from talking about Vigilante Fish for an hour.
Let's go.
And it stops now. Who's the song about? Joe, who's the song about?
I read on genius.com that it's about Scott Braun, aka Scooter.
So it's about Scooter. It's not about Borchetta.
I don't know who it's about. It's fiction. It's fiction. We're not putting Taylor's lyrics on trial.
Fine.
But
yeah, it's fine. Okay. It's about an antagonist.
It's Mad Woman Part 2. It's the sequel to Mad Woman. Some people have speculated that those songs are about Taylor's very public rival, Scooter Braun.
I like it. It's Billie Eilish.
I don't like this song. I don't want to listen to this song.
What?
But it is a brutal entry in the catalog.
Oh, wait. Can I just get a quick roll call? Lindsay, Karen, JP, Vigilante-ish, yay, nay?
I think it's mid, but I like... She's trying something, and I appreciate
she's definitely
that.
Trying something. JP?
JP?
This is
JP?
Her trying.
It's Bad Blood Part 2.
Mm.
She's not trying something that new for her.
Oh, it is.
Wow.
There you go. Very Billy. But you guys, John, I think, and this comes back to the reputation point, and you, reputation boyfriend, folklore girlfriend, you like campy theatrical Taylor in a way that I want... grounded, down to earth.
I also like
braid,
grounded, down to earth Taylor.
Taylor, not cat eye Taylor.
Look, I don't dislike that version of Taylor. That version of Taylor is the entire raison d'etre of why we're here 15 years later, right? Like, that's why we're here.
Yes.
We all showed up for that. And to go back to like a podcast trope from 4 years ago or 6 years ago, all we wanted was a Joni Mitchell record. Like, all we wanted, and we got Folklore, which is, I'm sorry, it's not that to me, but I do like that version of Taylor a lot. But one of the things that I found so refreshing about Reputation, everybody take a drink. One of the things I found so refreshing about Reputation is it was the first time that I felt like Taylor leaned into a version of her own art that was uncomfortable, but her sheer songwriting skill, choice and collaborator, and overall sense of performing in theater allowed her to transcend what I thought were not organically delivered Taylor Swift songs, but they became, in my mind, crucial to the narrative of who she could be in the pop sphere. And I think it's the first time that I think she really directly entertained that idea of how she might pivot and grow and evolve. And everything subsequent to that has been an ebbing. It's been a receding. And I was hoping on some level, I mean, look, Folklore Evermore, you give it a pass because of the pandemic, her and Aaron Dessner, like in a verdant field somewhere, like screaming at each other, you know, like whatever. It's a different kind of records. They're fine. But I was hoping that Midnight would be taken as an opportunity to ponder what the big picture of Taylor Swift's next 5 to 10 years could sound like. But really what we end up with is kind of like a coda to the last 5 years.
Yeah, I feel like I know less where she's going from here than I did.
There's nothing
before.
Yeah, it's not there.
Well, she's going on tour.
Hey, yo!
And that was a great point in your review, John. And yeah, JP, keep going on that point because I think you guys are right.
I mean, you said how Anti-Hero is going to sound good in an arena. This album is those big open spaces rather than the sort of crouched over in the woodlands interiority of Folklore and Evermore. She's leaving space for people to yell along. Those Jack Antonoff productions, he's always got an arena in his head. Even when he's being quiet, there's always that spaciousness. And I do think that the sound of this album is, oh yeah, I remember what it was like to tour arenas. I do think it's geared for that.
We can picture the B stage where the Folklore Evermore interlude will come.
Another hot dog break. Okay, one last thing. So I was talking to Helen last night, a friend of the pod, who asked me to address this specifically. And it kind of touches on the bigger questions about Taylor's potential pivot or lack of pivot. There's been some discourse on Twitter. I think Ann Powers was bringing this idea up of like, when do female performers really have the opportunity to change and reinvent themselves or bring new perspective into their music? And that has a lot to do with having a child and kind of the before and after of that. And making the argument that perhaps Taylor is trapped in the amber of not having crossed into that part of her life yet. How do y'all read that? Because I have some thoughts on it, but I'm curious how everybody else reads that.
I thought it was a really interesting reading. I've been thinking about it a lot. It's not something I ever really considered, but I do think it fits within this record and even kind of what I was saying about marriage before, that there is a sense of almost antic stasis to this record that does, again, feel very millennial, and it feels very what we thought was going to be post-pandemic, but sort of we're still living in this changed world that's still really confusing and don't know what to do, like, you know, someone of her age. And again, she's been in this relationship for 5 or 6 years now. As far as we know, they're not engaged. She's thinking about marriage on this record, but comes out in a really ambivalent place. I found it to be a really instructive way of like reading this idea that we still consider her this like woman child, even though she's about to turn 33.
Joe, what's your energy on this particular line of thinking?
I haven't thought too much about Taylor as mother, but I think that this idea of a sort of arrested development and an extended adolescence, childhood has always been a huge theme in her music. The idea of children imagining what adult life is like. And I think it's tough. You've seen this in a lot of these mid to late career pop stars. Pop stars are older now. This generation of A-list star that we have, Kendrick, Drake, Beyonce, and Taylor getting up there. We're not used to, I think, people dominating the top of the charts into their 30s and 40s. It's complicated. And yeah, I think they have one foot in their glory days and one foot in whatever's coming next. And we joke around, but it's Taylor Swift divorce album. Like, that's the real next phase. Motherhood, sure. But like, divorce album is like, let's where you imagine go. Her ending up. God forbid. Like, I'm not wishing
we've had this conversation before on the podcast.
Yeah, but yeah. And I think that life changes give you material. I think to bring it back to Drake, as we always do, Drake and Taylor, two defining artists of our lifetime and constantly in conversation, though never in collaboration. They both need new material. They both need something else to write about.
Karen, what do you think about this?
I think it is really interesting, and I haven't given it a ton of thought. I think like her signifiers of maturity have always been like, I'm drinking, you know, or I'm cursing.
Yeah.
Part of the issue with the backwards lookingness of this record sonically is, and content wise, is if you had put me to sleep 10 years ago and woken me up 10 years from now and said, this is the record Taylor Swift released in 2017, I would have said, sure, no problem. Like, there's nothing that marks it as a product of the present. There's nothing that marks it as a product of a particular phase in her life. It does feel like removed from a broad picture life narrative, except for the kind of oblique, you know, people have these expectations about marriage of me, and I'm maybe not totally sure about what's going to happen with that. But apart from that, sonically, there's almost nothing that marks it as the work of 2022. And to me, that's frustrating. And I think the idea that Anne put out there is extremely fascinating. But also, if you listen to Reputation, that was Taylor evolving and taking on a different version of what her sound and art could be like. And Karen, I know you think about this a lot. I can't help but think about Madonna.
Well,
and Madonna's consistent.
I was
just going to serve you up. Madonna's consistent reinventions, both, I assume, even before she had her first child.
Part of this also is that, like, what type of artist is Taylor? Like, do we think of her as a confessional songwriter, a country artist, a folk artist, and a singer-songwriter mean, in which we interpret all of her first-person songs to be about herself, and then she shifts to become a pop star? We don't think that everything that Madonna or Beyonce or Katy Perry says is necessarily about themselves, right? Beyonce just made an entire, basically, concept album about going out and partying, which does not sound like the work of a quote-unquote mother. don't know why I had to have that in quotes. It doesn't didn't sound like the work of a parent.
That's rude, Karen.
No, it reminds me of Jesse.
Moms party too.
Moms can party too. But, you know, like when Madonna had that shift, I mean, so she, I don't want to say she did it first, but she did almost everything first. She became one of the first pop stars to address parenthood on Ray of Light in 98. And she had a couple of songs on there about becoming a mother. And I thought they were really effective and they were moving and they were sonically really interesting. That was the beginning of another very sparkly disco period for her. I feel like Taylor's kind of trapped between these two things. Like, do we want her to be a pop star writing about abstract things or just love or the world? Or do we want everything to still be about herself? I don't know. I feel like that's part of this question.
And none of the people on this episode have children, just to clarify. None of us have been so blessed to have had our art impacted by parenthood. So just putting that out there.
That's how we have so much time to talk about Taylor Swift.
On a Sunday afternoon. Real talk.
But I mean, I think some of Taylor's most interesting and compelling songwriting is the songs where she gets outside of herself. That's why I cited Getaway Car and Miss Americana before. That's the elements of folklore and Evermore that I like the most. I was thrilled that she had removed herself largely from the narrative in those places. And so part of the disappointment for me of this album is that it does feel like such a doubling back in that sense. But that doesn't mean that the writing has to be immature. I agree in general that I think she needs life to happen to her. And maybe when you're so famous and you have 280 million Instagram followers, you will never have life happen to you again. She can never walk down the street. I don't know. It may be the true limitation is just her scale.
Everybody, Karen, JP, Lindsay, Joe, always a thrill. We could have done this for 6 hours or more. That is our show. One thing I would like to emphasize to everybody who is concerned about our critiques of Taylor Swift and this album is that I'm only cryptic and Machiavellian because I care. Listen to every podcast ever at nytimes.com/podcast. Email us at podcast@nytimes.com. Get in the Discord, get in the Facebook group, subscribe to podcasts anywhere you get your audio content, Google, Apple, Stitcher, Spotify, et cetera, et cetera. Pedro Rosado from Headstepper Media is our able producer, especially able on a weekend and on short notice and on fast turnaround. Shout out to Pedro. We will be back next week, and you know we are going out with Vigilante Fish. Well, he was doing lies and crossing all of mine. Someone told his white collar crimes to the FBI. I don't dress for villains.